So we're in 2 Samuel chapter 2, and in chapter 1, just as review, or if you were here or if not, just to bring you up to date, that's when David discovered that Saul had been killed, that Saul was dead, and we talked about all that when we went through chapter 1. And so, you know, Saul was king of Israel, David had been anointed the new king of Israel, and so now, logically, we assume David's just going to go in there and claim the throne of Israel, and that's, you know, going to be how it's all going to end. That'd be a nice, you know, ending to your Hollywood movie, that he just goes in, there's a huge procession, everyone's cheering, you know, they didn't have balloons, but something's going up in the air, and they're all excited, you know, and that's what we would expect to happen. But, you know, unfortunately, we know that reality, especially when it comes to, you know, government and all that, is not so simple. And so it wasn't that simple in David's time either. He's going to begin his ascent to the throne of Israel today. But it's just the beginning. It's not going to complete the process, as it were. And so the first question David would have as he's, you know, supposed to become this king now of his nation is, how should he do this? And so David wisely does, we're going to see first, what all of us should do in our decisions too, and that is he seeks the Lord. So let's read from 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 1. It says, then it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said to him, go up. So David said, where shall I go up? And he said, to Hebron. So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. And David brought up his men who were with him, each with his household. And they lived in the cities of Hebron. Then the men of Judah came, and there anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, it was the men of Jabesh Gilead who buried Saul. And so the Lord, in response to David seeking him and asking him, should I go up to Judah? The Lord says, yes, it's time to go back to Judah. Remember, he's been living in the land of the Philistines there, actually kind of on a border town now, in Ziklag, but now it's time to go back into Judah and be there with his people. And further, he should go to Hebron specifically. And Hebron is a significant city at that time, and still is today, I would say, in terms of when you think about everything that took place there. You recall that at this time, Jerusalem is not actually a city controlled by Israel. And so, because we would think, well, you're going to be a king of Israel, you go to Jerusalem. You know, of course, that's the capital. But it wasn't at that time. It was actually controlled by the Jebusites. The Israelites did not have control of Jerusalem, even though it's kind of like in the middle of Israel. And so Hebron is where David goes. And Hebron has had many names in the Bible. It's one place that's called Kirjath Arba. Another place is called Mamre. These are other just synonyms for this city of Hebron. And it's a place near the cave where Abraham and Sarah were buried. It's about 20 miles south of Jerusalem. And today, unfortunately, there's a mosque right on top of where Abraham and Sarah are supposed to be buried there, and are buried there, or were buried there in Israel. And so God then just sends him then to this place, sends him to Hebron. Go to Hebron, live in Hebron, and just watch what happens. And what happens there is what David would have hoped would have happened, is that the clan of Judah anoints him as their king there in Hebron. And remember from our study of 1 Samuel 30, that previously when David had brought in all of this spoil from the defeat of this Amalekite band that had taken away his family, and he recovered his family and all of that. Well, he also got all this additional bounty from them because they've been raiding in Judah and other places. Well, then he gives all these gifts to the cities in Judah, to different people in Judah. And it seems, I said at that time, that he was both sharing in God's bounty there by doing that, because he had had this great increase. He wanted to share it with God's people, which is an awesome thing to do. But he also was making a kind of a political move there by, you know, sending gifts ahead of him into the land. You know, it's like, hey, you know, I've just enriched you, just in case that influences your decision about who's you're going to be your leader. Sort of greasing the skids a little bit, as it were, to his ascent. Well, now he's seeing that benefit that, you know, we could have predicted with an easy transition into power over Judah. I mean, there's like, oh yeah, this is David. We want him to be king. And remember that David is of Judah to begin with. So it's not like he was a foreigner, an outsider. He's one of their own. And he had done this. And so they recognize him as their king. And because I'm saying all that, I don't mean to take away from the work of God's Spirit in all of this and making David king. That's not my intention at all. But, you know, God certainly knows the hearts of men and of people. And so no doubt David led David in all these things, that he knew this was going to help David, you know, achieve the goal that God had of him becoming king there. But unfortunately, David's popularity, we're going to see, does not extend past the borders of Judah at this point. Let's read from 2 Samuel 2, verse 5. It says, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed of the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul your Lord and have buried him. Now may the Lord show loving kindness and truth to you, and I also will show this goodness to you, because you have done this thing. Now therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. He made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, even over all Israel. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. The time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. And so David is popular there in Judah, but you can see that elsewhere in Israel, well, there's already another king. Now, Jabesh-Gilead, it mentions there, Jabesh-Gilead was loyal to Saul, fiercely loyal. Remember, his first military victory way back when was delivering Jabesh-Gilead. We studied that in 1 Samuel when they had been, you know, taken over by this other nation. Remember also then from 1 Samuel 31 that the men of Jabesh-Gilead took a really risky venture, and they went and recovered the bodies of Saul and Jonathan from within Philistine territory. It was very dangerous to get there, then to retrieve those bodies that were, you know, hanging publicly for everyone to see, and then take them all the way back to Israel to bury them. So they did that at great risk to themselves, and it showed just this fierce loyalty they had towards Saul. And David commends that here. David is commending that loyalty that they had to Saul. And in fact, it's something, you know, really, when you think about it, this sounds like something David himself would have done. You know, if he would have known about Saul's death earlier than he did, he might have tried to do this, you know, to go and get him. It sounds exactly like something like David and his brave men would have done. And so in verse 6 there, David is really extending an olive branch to the people of Jabesh-Gilead. And he's encouraging them in verse 7, you know, to come into his kingdom, you know, to follow him. You know, Judah's made me king, by the way. You know, I think you guys are awesome and I'm king over here. So maybe, you know, put two and two together there. But as I already said, and as we already read, there's already another king of Israel. In our verses here, it lists several territories of this other king, this Ish-bosheth. But then it basically concludes, you know, over all Israel, basically, is now under Ish-bosheth. Everyone but Judah, that is. And this man Abner, who made him king there, remember, was, you know, Saul's military commander, like his general. But also he was his cousin. And this was a cousin of Saul's. And Abner, in this battle that had taken Saul and Jonathan, well, he had survived it. You know, he was doing well. And so he then takes this action to establish a new king. And to his credit, he doesn't try to take the throne. I mean, how many times you see that in history or in a movie or something like that, that you know, the leader of the land dies, and then the general says, oh, now I'm king. You know, who's going to stand against me? I've got the military that all follows me. And so that would have been a temptation. But to his credit, he doesn't do that. You know, he doesn't try and take control. He instead installs another one of Saul's sons as king. And really, as we study further into 2 Samuel in the coming weeks, we're going to find that Abner really is an honorable man in the end, is what it appears. And he's the real power behind, you know, the throne now of Israel, behind Ish-bosheth. I mean, he's the one who's really holding that together. But clearly, Abner, for all his positive traits, was not understanding what God's will was at this time. You know, God had already anointed David as king, but Abner doesn't get that, doesn't know that. We're not sure why he does this, but he doesn't recognize that David is king. And so he makes the new king, Ish-bosheth. And we've not previously met this son of Saul. We've met three others, but we've not met this one. And commentators believe he has been mentioned until now because he was born after Saul became king. And that's why he wasn't mentioned earlier in Saul's lineage. He was therefore the youngest, and the scriptures paint him as the most worthless of Saul's sons also, because his name, Ish-bosheth, means man of shame. What a great name for your king, right? A man of shame. You know, this is our leader. And it was actually the second name that he was given in the Bible. In 1 Chronicles 8, verse 33 is one place. In 1 Chronicles 8, 33, it lists his name as Esh-Baal. And you recognize the name Baal if you've studied the Bible much in the Old Testament, because that's the pagan god Baal. And that name, Esh-Baal, means fire of Baal. I mean, wow, what a great name. You know, either you're named after a pagan god or you're, you know, man of shame. You know, either one is really a great name. Now, the second one at least got rid of this pagan deity, you know, from your name, but it doesn't inspire a lot of confidence in the man when his name is shameful. And other than this, we don't know much about him. Other than that, his reign will be short. We read it'll be 2 years. But honestly, as we look at the scriptures, we don't see anything to paint the contrary to what his name meant. You know, that his name was this shameful man. And people's names did often, you know, were used to attribute or to describe attributes of that person. And so it seems like, yes, indeed, he was a shameful person. His reign ends, we'll see, in a few weeks or maybe next week, by an assassination. His own men assassinate him. So obviously he didn't have a strong following even amongst his own people as king. So everything seems to point to, yes, he was a man of shame. But he's made king there in a city we've not studied before in 1 or 2 Samuel, and that's Mahanaim. And the exact location of this city is not known today, but certainly it was to the north. Everyone agrees it was to the north in Israel. And David's capital, remember, was in Hebron, which is to the south in Israel. So they're a safe distance away from each other. And they're not next door neighbors, you know. It's not like, you know, Taylor and Hutto or something. They're quite a distance apart, these two. And in fact, in the future, when Absalom, you remember in the future that David's family becomes a problem for him when he's older, and Absalom, his son, actually takes over the throne for a time being. Well, David escapes to Mahanaim is where he escapes to sort of regroup and get his military together, and then he goes back and regains the throne from his son. And there's a little bit of foreshadowing here the writer of 2 Samuel is giving us, because it tells us that David's capital in verse 11 there, I think it was, will be for 7 years in Hebron. We'll see in chapter 2 or in chapter 5 of 2 Samuel that David actually then, that's when he takes over Jerusalem. He conquers the Jebusites that are inhabiting Jerusalem and moves his capital to Jerusalem then. Well, as you might expect, when there are two armies in one nation, there's going to be some fighting breakout. And that's what we're going to see next as we read a little more. In 2 Samuel 2, verse 12, it says, "Now Abner, the son of Ner, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon and with the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on the one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. Then Abner said to Joab, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." So they arose and went over by count, 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. Each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore that place was called Helkath Hazarim, which is in Gibeon. That day the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And so these two sides meet at Gibeon. And Gibeon is believed to be modern-day El Jib in Israel. And it's about 6 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And so essentially they met in the middle ground. One came down from the north, one came up from the south. They met there in the middle, just north of Jerusalem. And you have Joab, who has David's army, and you have Abner, who has really what is Saul's army. Now it's his son's army. And they decide, you know, let's have a little contest here. And so each one brings forward 12 of their champions, and they're going to have this gladiator-like battle. It's just for entertainment, really. It's not like they're representing each nation. You remember when David battled Goliath? Goliath said, "Hey, anyone slays me, we'll be your servants." You know, he's like he was going to represent his whole nation. Well, that's not what's happening here. This is just some, you know, ghoulish or primitive entertainment here to watch a gladiator fight to the death battle, basically, of the 12 of their soldiers. And it's kind of hard to read. It sounds almost like both sides, like all 12 men from each side died. But that's not actually the way we should understand it. It's actually David's men slaughtered Saul's men here, like really fast is what happened. And the place is named Helkath Hazarim, which means field of daggers, because of these short swords that David's men used that killed these other men. Well, from this, you know, crude entertainment, this, you know, kind of disgusting entertainment, a full battle now ensues. And we get a piece of that in verse 17 when it says the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. It continues then, as I'll read in verse 18. It says, "Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel. And Asahel was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles which is in the field. Asahel pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, 'Is that you, Asahel?' And he answered, 'It is I.' So Abner said to him, 'Turn to your right or to your left and take hold of one of the young men for yourself and take for yourself his spoil.' But Asahel was not willing to turn aside from following him. Abner repeated again to Asahel, 'Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?' However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of the spear, so that the spear came out at his back. And he fell there and died on the spot. And it came about that all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still." So pretty graphic imagery. Apologize for that. It's pretty gross to think about. But, you know, David's men here, no doubt bolstered, you know, and emboldened by this hands-down victory of David's men here, the 12 men. Now they take off after Abner and his men. They, like, start chasing them, and they're in full retreat mode as David's men are pursuing. And in this, we learn of the tragic end of Asahel. Asahel was the youngest brother of Joab, and Joab is the leader of David's army that we've been reading about. And as Abner says there in verse 22, he's like, "How am I going to face your brother? You know, if I harm you, you know, don't keep following me." But Asahel was faster than Abner, and so he keeps pursuing him. But he was no match for Abner in a fight. And Abner knew that. Abner's like, you know, if you follow me, this is not going to be good. You know, you need to go fight someone else. And so even though Abner sought to avoid it, Abner ends up killing Asahel because Asahel will not stop pursuing him. He kills him with the butt end of the spear. And this was opposite of the pointy end, if you will. I think we all can grasp that. But even though it was, you know, that, you know, we think of more of a blunt end, it actually was still sharp. They made them somewhat sharp. They didn't come to a point, but they were still sharp so that they could stick in the ground and it would stay there. You know, so it had some sharpness to it. And with that, then he, you know, kills Asahel. And then there's sort of this foreboding scene there in verse 23, as like from a movie, as everyone who comes upon Asahel's dead body, they just stop and they're silent there. I mean, they're just like in shock that Asahel was killed here. And it really shows the reverence that people had for him as Joab's brother. Like, oh man, this is really bad. No, this guy should not have died here. And it kind of hints to us that this ain't over either. In the future, there's going to be more to come about this in the future as we study further in 2 Samuel, especially once Joab finds out what happened to his brother and who did it. Well, finally, we see then that the battle is going to come to an end in verse 24, 2 Samuel 2:24. It says, "But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. And when the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which is in front of Giah by the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. The sons of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became one band. And they stood on the top of a certain hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, 'Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers?' Joab said, 'As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each from following his brother.' So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the people halted and pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight any more. Abner and his men then went through the Arabah all that night. So they crossed the Jordan, walked all morning, and came to Mahanaim. Then Joab returned from following Abner. When he had gathered all the people together, 19 of David's servants, besides Asahel, were missing. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men, so that 360 men died. And they took up Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men went all night until the day dawned at Hebron." And so the battle, you know, as I said, comes to an end here. And the exact location of all these places mentioned here is uncertain for some of them. Obviously, we know where Bethlehem is, but some of the other places. But what is clear is that, or around this hill, Ammah, Abner's forces kind of regroup there. They all come behind Abner there. And they seem to have found a defensible position, is what's happened, and one from which they have some strength. They can at least fight back a little better than they were when they were on the run. And from that position, Abner suggests, you know, let's end this bloodshed. We're killing each other. We're all of Israel. You know, we need to stop fighting each other. And Joab's army, really, if they continue to fight now, they're probably going to endure more casualties since Abner is now in a better position there. They can probably fight much more effectively. Joab says that, you know, if he hadn't said anything, we were going to pursue you guys all through the night. You know, we were going to keep going. But he listens to him and stops the fighting. Both sides then make these long journeys home. It took them, you know, overnight to get home and so forth. Abner and his men back to the north in Mahanaim, and Joab and David's men to the south to Hebron. Well, what should we take away from all this? This has been a kind of a crazy chapter with a lot of fighting and things. What should we take away from all this? Well, what I see as I go through this chapter is I see that there are three different voices that the people in this chapter are following. And there are three voices that we can follow today. And it's so important that we choose the right voice that we're going to follow in our lives. I want to take them in reverse order of how they appear in the chapter. The first voice that I see that is followed by one of the main characters is that of Asahel, the tragic end of Asahel, and he was following the voice of pride to his doom. Asahel, as we read, was chasing Abner, this very experienced warrior. He's like, I'm gaining on him. I'm gaining on him. You know, you can tell he's catching him because he's so fast. And Asahel no doubt thinks, you know, I'm going to take down the big guy. I'm going for the big boss. You know, like when you play your video games and at the end there's the big boss, you know, and he's like, I'm going to get the big boss here. You know, I'm not going to waste my time with the pawns. You know, I'm going for not the king, but, you know, the big guy himself here. Asahel may have thought in his mind, you know, my brother Joab's a great warrior. And so I must be too. You know, I'm going to be a great warrior too. But over Abner's warnings, his counsel, and even his pleading with Asahel, Asahel continues the pursuit and he dies as a result of it. And so I would like to suggest to you that Asahel was not guided by God in what he was doing. He was not guided by his experience as a warrior in what he was doing or wisdom, but simply by his pride. In his pride, he thought he could take this guy down. And because of his pride, he fell that day. He died by the hand of Abner. And, you know, today we're tempted by pride as well. You know, pride is one of those voices that calls out to all of us, you know, at different times, sometimes unexpectedly, in unexpected times. And, you know, the world around us celebrates this and reveres proud people, you know, in this life. And the world looks on those who are humble and thinks, well, this person's weak, you know, because they're humble. And so if we're not careful, we can get caught up in that mentality too and think that, you know, being proud is where it's at. You know, that's how I need to be. Just like Adam and Eve, you know, they thought they could be like God. You know, they believed the lie of Satan that they could be like God. And it was pride that tempted them there. And so sometimes we too can picture ourselves greater than we are when we're fed by our pride. But Proverbs 16:18 tells us that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before stumbling. That was Proverbs 16:18. And so as we go through life, we don't want to be proud. We don't want to be led by our pride. We want to be humble people. And I think a great definition of humility is not thinking less of ourselves, but just thinking of ourselves less. And I love that definition of humility. Not thinking less of ourselves, but thinking of ourselves less.